Well, it's good pop, and good pop is good pop.
All right, we'll leave it there. Kind of like ABBA, right?
Yeah. It's like, Leslie, don't start now.
Oh, nice.
See, because that's the Dua Lipa song. Yes,
it is. Nice. Okay. Another point for Chris. The score is Chris 1, everyone else 0. All right, let's get serious. Talk about testing, in particular the lineups. They continue today for people trying to get their hands on a rapid test. We're not sure how much longer those pop-up clinics are going to go because, as you heard from Dr. Kieran Moore yesterday, they are in the process of prioritizing them. They're going to go basically to essential workers who are trying to keep the healthcare system afloat, right? Well, this morning I talked to a Dr. Dalia Hassan from Waterloo. She is a doctor, very well respected. And she says prioritizing just for essential workers, it's not the way this should be going. Listen to this.
Right now, the federal government has committed to sending all the provinces and territories 140 million rapid tests. This means that every Canadian would have access to one rapid test per week for the month of January if the provincial and territorial governments distribute those rapid tests to the general public. And so we are urging the government at the provincial and territorial level to distribute the rapid tests to every single household because everybody benefits from protecting their community from the transmission of COVID.
It's a strength in numbers argument here. The more you can actually get it out there, the more they're able to catch it. Chris?
The game may change here when students start heading back to school. That could be, that could really throw around the apple cart here because I'm thinking to myself, okay, so in what situation would we have here where a private citizen receiving a kit is going to be able to really feasibly use it in any kind of manner that would be underneath current public health recommendations? For example, we have private gatherings are capped at 5 people indoors. You have 10 people outdoors right now. So we'd have several situations where really if somebody is getting a private test, they're using it for a situation that's not as ideal as, say, sending a kid back to school and, of course, keeping people employed in our very key in our key sectors at this time. It's a good perspective to have, though. It's interesting to hear that.
Well, and part of the problem is they sent home 5 kits per kid, right, at school for the holidays. And what I heard, some people were using them to test not only the kids, but family members before they got together. And we've been told that's wasting this test for several reasons. Groupie, what do you think?
Well, what do you want families to do, right? We're having Christmas. They want to go see grandma, and they have these kits. And so this is you're on your own, folks. This is survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they call it a luxury, this is a luxury now. So, good luck. And, you know, unfortunately, we have the LTC issue again. And that's dominating the news headlines. And we're going to do a story on that today as well. Because we're back to isolation. We're back to staff shortages in LTC.
Yeah.
We're back to, you know, horrible stories.
Loneliness and tears. Yeah, they're back. One more note. Dr. Hassan was telling me that with Omicron, things have changed in way in which rapid tests work. Because she said not only do you need to get a swab of your nose, but also add saliva to it. I'm going to run the interview a little later. So if you're lucky enough to have one of those rapid tests, don't just do the nose anymore. Also, she says the saliva, because Omicron doesn't go up into the nose as much as Delta did, which is kind of interesting, technical, but also we simplify it for you coming up. All right, next we go to Quebec for story number 2, expanding the use of COVID-19 vaccine passports. You're going to need one in the near future to go to the liquor store or the pot stores. Do we need to jump on board this idea, folks? Chris?
Well, I think it might be more effective if they do something like that in Ontario, where the options of going and buying liquor are a lot more limited. I mean, when they announced the CAQ measure yesterday in Quebec, I thought, my first thought was big deal. You can go and get a wide selection of beer, wine, spirits, whatever you want at a lot of corner stores, for example. In Quebec, the distribution that in that province is completely different. There was one thing that stood out to me, would I felt like almost buried the lead, is that you had to Christian Dubé essentially say that, okay, in the future, Quebec is going to switch to 3 doses being necessary for a proof of vaccination. And that makes me think a lot again about here we are once more with the differences between Ottawa and Gatineau. Is that a switch that Ontario is going to make? And what kind of effect could that have in people going back and forth between our two provinces and, well, maybe only a couple of months from now?
Are three shots the new vaccine passport? Is that a good idea, Krupe?
Well, if full vaccination now should mean three shots.
Yeah.
LTC is, of course, going to get a fourth shot, but full vaccination means three shots as far as, as far as I'm concerned, who am I, right? But obviously with a booster and the importance of it and trying to avoid hospitalization, three shots is full vaccination.
Well, there were a number, remember, you may recall before any of this started with the Omicron wave, there were several epidemiologists, I believe including Dr. Isaac Bogosh, who were suggesting that it's looking more likely that the vaccine, the mRNA vaccine, is a three-course vaccine, similar to, say, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, right?
Mm.
And that, it's like that could have played a role, I think, in more of the decisions going ahead. Now, Ontario, they have not indicated that they could make that change yet. But now that Quebec is going down that path, clearly, you wonder if the rest of Canada is going to follow that as well.
I know there's also some issues. You talked about the provinces and the jurisdictions, but also recognizing the shots. For example, I got my first two shots in Quebec because I was living across the river. And then since then, I've moved to the Ottawa side. And so I got my third shot under OHIP. And when I did so, I went to the pharmacy and they had no, of course, registering of my first two shots because I got them in Quebec. So as far as the province of Ontario is concerned, I've had just one shot. And so they won't recognize. And I tried to download the equivalent of the vaccine passport, the QR code, and it said, no, you need to have a second shot to get it.
And when this is all over, when most of it's all over.
Yeah.
Do you think that we should sit down, the provinces and the feds? Well, the provinces would never relinquish control, but don't you know, we need more of a national approach. I'm not saying that the provinces... Yeah. Because that point you just raised, right? That wouldn't happen if, say, the feds had the control over that.
Yeah, and I tried to download it. I don't know if we trust the feds enough to be able.
Yeah, well, that's the issue, right?
Yeah, it's just like,
who do you trust?
Yeah. Like these are problems what you're experiencing right now, Leslie, that clearly need to be ironed out. But one thing I look at is that if we do have if we do adapt some kind of national strategy, to me that just sounds like something that's going to be muddled down with bureaucracy. Again, because you cannot make these kind of decisions.
Yeah, well, without, same with the province.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but then you're talking about, well, the prime minister wants to do this, so we need to have every single province and territory leader on board, and that would slow down response, honestly.
Yeah, we need some kind of streamlining.
Yeah, and you think we've had, 2 years to try and figure it out? I guess they're flying by the seat of their pants, clearly, and they're kind of making decisions as the pieces move, and you got to give them some validation for that, but also there are other issues they could have foreseen and they've dropped.
Well, if you do want to streamline something, there's a great example of that right now. Again, as we have people reportedly lining up on the street out in Canada to try to get a rapid test, even if you do not have enough for every single Canadian, if you are going to have some kind of general public approach, which is by the looks of things disappearing in Ontario now for rapid tests, and why not even just get some kind of deal done with Canada Post to send them, not even to every house, just pick them at random off a list. They end up wherever they are. It's not how is that any worse than a bunch of random people lining up to get these tests for unknown purposes?
I don't know why they're lining up. Apparently, we have a trillion.
Yeah. They're sitting somewhere.
They're sitting there. Yeah, and every second day, we hear you're getting 12 million, 140 million. It makes your head spin.
Like, I was surprised yesterday, actually, when we did not have a complete shutdown of the idea of getting them out to the general public. The approach that Ontario was taking is if there are any left after we tick off all these boxes, then distribution to the general public would continue. The way that Dr. Paul Romeliotis was talking yesterday, it was suggesting that was not going to happen. But maybe that's coming from the approach of you just take a look logistically where the province is saying that it wants 18 million a week to try to prioritize for the groups that it is looking at right now. The idea, perhaps, of having any out to the general public, at least in the month of January, seems
unlikely. You can always buy them because lots of people have tons of money or just wasting away in the bank.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
I want to read to you a note that I received from someone in Toronto. He's a single. He's not a single dad. He's a dad on paternity leave, and he's written the premier. And I want to read this to you because he says he is part of the silent majority right now. And he says, Premier, I'm sending you this note because my neighbors are breaking. Never have I seen so many grown men and women cry openly in the streets. Their kids are hanging on by a thread. The parents are cracking. I know you believe lockdowns are saving lives. Perhaps this is true, but they're also killing people, and they are certainly destroying lives. I read through the story explaining why you moved to close schools. I have no doubt doctors calling for lockdowns have good intentions, but lockdowns can't be the playbook we turn to anymore. Our hospitals have been broken for decades. Talks about for 20 years we've known that. Burnt out nurses, code oranges, and hallway medicine. But let's be honest, we've ignored those concerns all these years, and now these doctors have your ear. They have the world's ear. But they'll do anything to fix healthcare. But sheltering humanity in place can't be the solution. Do you agree, Krupe, that this is a growing sentiment?
Yes, yes. I think people are, obviously they're at wit's end. And I mean, what is the hospital capacity issue is very serious. So what are you going to do about that? There's a no-win situation for governments right here. And we've talked about it before. We're not Wuhan. We can't build a hospital in 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to build more hospital capacity more healthcare capacity.
But I think the dad's point is, it's great to hear with the doctors and how frustrated they are. And we know the consequences of not, you know, bolstering the healthcare system. But in the meantime, the majority of people who aren't in hospitals, who won't be affected, are suffering equally mentally as those who are going into hospital who are sick with COVID. I mean, Chris, he claims to be part of the silent majority. I know a lot of people are done here, but at what point does the premier start to hear these
people? I dislike whenever people use that term, and for one thing, making a claim about how the effects of this are equal or greater than COVID-19. If you do not have statistics to back that up, I'm sorry, I do not want to hear it.
What's the metric?
Yeah, exactly. You need to have that. However, that sentiment and that concern definitely that is still there, and that is still valid at this time. You know how we have that gimmick about Black Monday, the so-called most depressing day of the year that happens in the month of January, and they say, well, because it's a Monday, it's the worst day for depression.
Yeah,
it'd probably
we've had it for 30 days.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's like, find me a more depressing day in Ontario this year than Wednesday, January 5th, and that is going to have definite consequences.
Is Ontario and Quebec, are we the only two jurisdictions that are like locked down like this right now in North America?
I think to the effect that we are. I mean, there are still restrictions and protocols.
I believe Newfoundland was enacting some kind of restrictions earlier this week.
They had 12 cases there or something?
Yeah, but if you fly out to BC, you can go into indoor dining, go to a gym, right?
Yeah.
And Sunday, I'm going to watch the San Francisco 49ers hopefully win their way into a playoff spot full stadium in Los Angeles, California.
America.
It is America.
They don't care.
And are we envious of America right now, given that there are people who
They have extra. One person said on social media they have a hospital in every corner in Florida.
Yeah. Yeah. And lots of beds.
But here's what's still so complicated about this right now is that do you envy the United States healthcare system where if you do get COVID-19, you're talking about and end up in a hospital or an ICU, you're talking about a tens of thousands of dollars hospital bill, and I do not envy that.
Yeah. Well, we remember and forget that at the same time. Absolutely. All right, coming up, the Conservative leader, Aaron O'Toole, saying something yesterday that raised a few eyebrows. When it comes to the unvaccinated, maybe we need to accommodate more. We'll discuss that on the other side. News Talk 580 CFRA.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
$13 billion. That's $13 billion with a B. Yeah, that is the record-breaking results of 2021 for Ottawa real estate. So what does it look like in 2022? Well, our go-to guy, of course, is Frank Napolitano, mortgage agent. And you know the show, Open House, the Real Estate and Mortgage Show, heard weekends right here on CFRA. Good morning, Frank. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year and good morning, Leslie.
Are things quiet this early on in January traditionally, and how are they today?
Well, generally, things are quiet. The only difference, the big thing right now is there's no inventory. So I had a couple of clients over the Christmas break that actually found a home that they liked and didn't have a shot at it. What we saw earlier on last year is what we saw during the Christmas break is they lost the house and they bid about $20,000 over, and apparently the house went for about $1,000 over list.
How many over list? How much?
$200,000 over list.
Wow, it's back.
It's back. At least in some. Now, this house, and I asked the realtor about it. I said, like, tell me why this happened. And she's scratching her head saying, I have no idea, Frank. She said, Frank, I mean, a house that was larger than this one sold during the crazy times in May. and it sold for $150,000 less than this one did. So it makes no sense. The only thing she can guess is that somebody from the GTA probably was the one that overbid for it.
Got it. So in other words, somebody who sold their house for a lot more came here and was willing to bid more to get the house because they know overall it's a good deal compared to Toronto, I guess.
Yeah, they may have sold a townhouse in Toronto and paid the same for this house here in Ottawa, for all we know.
Yeah. So you're not surprised we set the record last year because you see it, but is it sustainable?
I don't think it's sustainable personally. I think number one, I think there's a lot of equity now that a lot of Canadians have built into their homes, which is awesome. You know, I think we always hear about the negativity and the debts are the highest, but in actuality, unsecured debt since the pandemic started has come down by 30%. Mortgage debt has gone up, but many of us think that mortgage debt is good debt. I mean, you just live with the fact that you need a mortgage because it's a cost of living. It's but a lot of people have gotten rid of the unsecured debt, and it's interesting to hear that they want to make potentially mortgages a little bit tougher to get, yet unsecured debt is very easily attainable. And I think we need to change the way that's viewed. And I think there's nothing wrong with having mortgage debt if it means you don't have unsecured debt.
So they're sending you, applications where you're pre-approved for a $5,000 credit card, but they're going to turn you away for an actual mortgage potentially that is going to give you even, great return on your money one day.
Yeah, we're okay with you paying rent, but, at the same time, we'll also give you a $20,000 credit card at 20%. That's okay to carry, but you won't qualify for a mortgage, even though you're paying rent similar to what your mortgage payment would be, which is becoming tougher as these prices continue to go up. It's becoming tougher. And as rates start to go up, we've seen, we saw in 2021, we saw interest rates go up by about 0.75% on a 5-year fix. So, the same is expected in 2022, anywhere between 0.5 to 0.75% increase. So, that cost now is going to make it even tougher, specifically for first-time home buyers to get into their homes.
I was going to say the hardest part now is for the next generation who are trying to get in there. How are they doing it?
It's tough.
Yeah,
it's tough unless you've got a parent that can help or a family member that can help. It's really difficult, especially if you're single. I mean, if you're one person trying to buy a home, again, the rule of thumb is anywhere between 4 to 5 times your income. So, if the average home today is, it's close to 7 if you look at the single home. But, if you bring it down and look at some of the condos and stuff, at best case scenario, you might be able to get in the 5s somewhere, which means your income needs to be in excess of $100,000. And as a single person, for most, that's pretty tough to achieve.
So $100,000 just to get into the cheapest or the average, I guess, the average condo.
That's not even the average condo. Yeah, the average condo, not even the average townhouse, because townhouses are in the 6s these days. They're not in the, unless there's something wrong with it or, it's smaller and older and needs a lot of work, you might find one in the 5s, but very difficult to find anything in the 4s unless it's a condo these days.
Frank, last year, how many people went variable and how many locked in?
Well, the variable started to increase towards the latter part of the year. At the beginning of the year, obviously, when you can get a 5-year fixed rate in the range of 1.5%, then a lot of people went the 5-year fixed. But as that rate went up, and as we got to the latter part of 2021, where it had gone up 0.5 or 0.75 points, yet the prime rate remained intact, and some of the lenders increased what the discount was on the variable rate, we saw more and more people looking towards the variable. So even today, we've got a lender that'll do prime minus 1.3% on a variable high ratio purchase, which brings you all the way down to 1.15%. So, that's hard to give up. Now, I caution people, listen, prime rate is supposed to come up. So I would strongly urge you, if you want to take a variable, go ahead and take the variable. But set your payments a little bit higher. Set your payments as if you were 2 or 2.5%. That number one, you're taking advantage of the low interest rate by putting more money towards your mortgage and paying it down quicker. And number two, as rates go up, you've already conditioned yourself to have that payment because you set the payment higher so that you don't have to worry about it and lose sleep at nighttime knowing that the prime rate may go up maybe 0.5%. I mean, some think it'll be more, but I think 0.5% is where it's going to go up this year.
Can you make that change at any time or just when you're signing the mortgage? So if somebody's variable now and says, hey, I want to put go up an extra percent in paying it back, can they do it midterm?
Yeah, for sure. Most lenders have options. One bank, I think, is 10%, but most of them are 15 or 20%. So you can increase your payment by that 15 or 20% every year. So, by doing that, at least you're setting yourself up so that as prime rate goes up, it doesn't impact your mortgage payment. And again, you don't lose sleep at night worrying about rates going crazy. Because I don't believe that prime rate can go up that much. Keep in mind, before the pandemic, when our economy was absolutely humming, we were at 3.95% on the prime. So it's 1.5% more than what we are today. So even if you got a mortgage rate at 1.15% and it went up 1.5%, you would be up to 2.65%,
right?
Which is still fantastic.
Okay. If you're thinking about selling your house, is now the time to do it? Is that the takeaway here?
Well, the takeaway is that if you're thinking about selling your house and you've got somewhere else to go, please keep in mind, it's changed. I mean, it used to be that first you found a house and then you, or first you sell your house and then you go look for a house. Unfortunately, with the inventory where it is, less than a month's inventory in some neighborhoods, you've got to do it the other way around. You've got to actually find your house, and once your offer gets accepted, then sell your house. But with inventory as low as it is, the chances of your house selling is extremely high if it's priced right and if it's in great condition.
Typically, spring is when the market starts to warm up or heat up, and here we are. It's January. Do we expect this to continue to upwards through the spring?
If there's no inventory, or if the inventory remains where it is, which is likely, especially with the Omicron now and people having to stay home, I don't know that a lot of people want to put their house for sale. They don't want people in their house right now, so. The inventory is likely to remain low for the months of January and February, which means that there's going to be bidding wars for those that do want to buy it sooner rather than later, especially with the potential of interest rates going up. So, I wouldn't be surprised if the first 3 or 4 months of the year, again, there's not enough inventory to make it sound like it's the spring market, because generally during the spring market is when there's more houses on the market. But what I do believe is going to happen over the next 2 months is that there will be bidding on certain neighborhoods where there's the demand for that for those houses.
Which are the hottest neighborhoods right now?
Still Barrhaven, Riverside South seem to be the hottest, and obviously the core of the city. Mm-hmm. For those that
can't afford it,
can't afford it. Number one, I mean, you're looking at the Westboros and the Glebes that are so expensive. But at the end of the day, I think we saw last year people actually going outwards instead of inwards because they were able to work from home. It sounds like this COVID is going to be around for a while. I mean, I think at this time last year, we all thought once the vaccines come, we'd be done with it. But here we are, 3 shots for a lot of people, and still we're locked down. So now I think companies are also starting to rethink working from home as well, maybe as more permanent than just temporary. So which will hurt the downtown core. I think the downtown core is really going to feel it. But, apart from that, I mean, as far as owning a home, some people may start looking in the outskirts knowing that maybe they are going to be able to work from home for longer terms.
So would it be, if you're buying in, would it be make sense because of the downtown core being still quiet, you look downtown for what would be the equivalent of an entry-level condo?
Well, I think if a condo is what you want to start with, then I think that there could be some potential in the downtown core. There's buildings going up now. The cranes are there downtown. So over the next year, 2 years, we're going to see a lot more condos on the market. But if you're looking, if you're a first-time home buyer and you just want to get into the market, maybe that's the easiest and best way just to get yourself into the market.
Yeah.
The likelihood that those condos will go up in value is fairly good, I would think. I mean, if the average condo is $419,000, I'm pretty confident that that number will likely only go up. So there is money to be made as far as, you're not buying a condo and maybe having to sell it at the same price. If you live in it for 2 or 3 years, there's the opportunity for that value of that condo to go up and therefore build some equity so that you're ready to buy a townhouse or a single home 2, 3, 4 years down the road.
Great insight. Thank you, Frank. Appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure, and please continue to support local businesses and charities.
Absolutely. Frank Napolitano, of course, mortgage agent, and you know the show, Open House, the Real Estate Mortgage Show, heard weekends right here. It is 1020, News Talk 580 CFRA. Down in the
deep when your brain goes. This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Share your opinion now. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from. Standard text rates may apply.
Do we need to know the daily case counts that are being done for COVID in the province? Some infectious disease experts say, no, we don't need to anymore. It's time to scale back on that. The vast majority of the population is now protected with two doses. We don't need to know the case numbers every day. We certainly don't need to be publishing on the news every morning. That's according to Dr. Suman Chakrabarty, who, of course, is one of the voices that we've turned to throughout this whole thing. I know one group who are very happy that perhaps we're scaling back on this testing is those involved with the labs who have been overworked and underserviced. The CEO of the Medical Lab Professionals Association of Ontario is Michelle Hode, and she's back. Good morning and Happy New Year, Michelle.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Let's start with the question that it seems to be hitting a lot of sectors. Are you missing staff because of symptoms or asymptomatic testing?
Yes, we are. So we kind of are in that same dilemma. We've got people calling in sick that have COVID now. So,
wow.
You know, it's further affecting our shortages.
Yeah. How bad is it right now? If I know that the testing results are taking a little bit longer. It seems to be every week there seems to add an hour or two.
Yeah. So I think it depends on where you are in the province, but we've heard turnaround times of 12 hours up until, 50 hours right now. How has it been affecting us? I just had a conversation with a lab last night that now is looking, unfortunately, to potentially shut down their lab services because they can't provide that testing. So the tests will then get redirected to another lab. So
wow.
we're in a situation now where things are starting to get pretty serious.
Is this in a remote area or is this at least where they have one close by that can pick up the slack, so to speak?
Yeah, definitely closer by, but, these are our remote communities where the staff are so short and small that, if one or two people call in sick, you just can't afford that.
The shift to, for example, the testing changes, is that something you welcome and why?
Yes, definitely. And that's because I think what we're starting to notice is there has been some behavior in the last, I would say, 21 days where, there's been this hoarding of rapid tests. And I think it's important to understand that we've got rapid tests that are kind of our screening tools, and then we've got the PCR test that confirms. And because Omicron has been so tremendously infectious, and with the numbers going up dramatically, like getting a PCR test to confirm every single positive is something we just can't sustain with our healthcare system. So, getting a rapid test, if you have symptoms to confirm you have it and it shows up, you should stay assured that you have Omicron, so therefore don't go anywhere. So just reducing the number of PCR confirmations is just helping us just at least take a breath and try to catch up.
False positives, is that an issue with rapid tests?
False negatives is an issue, not necessarily false positive. If you're positive on a rapid test, there's a good chance that you've got COVID.
Okay. So it's if they miss it, that's one thing. But if they catch it, it's a pretty good guarantee.
Yes.
Sometimes it takes a couple of tests too, right? To actually
it
catch
does.
It. Yeah.
You know, it does, Leslie, but I've also been hearing like so many different scenarios where people are testing positive on a rapid test after they've had a negative PCR test.
Mm.
So I think it depends on where you are in that cycle. But, we're back to symptoms. We're back to just being logical. If you don't feel well, make sure you try to, I look at it from our perspective and what we do in our household is, if no one's feeling well, no one's going anywhere. We both work full time, but we've got rapid tests. If we're heading into work, we do that before we go, but we've just got to be logical.
Do you think it would be beneficial to just flood every Canadian with rapid tests if the federal government just mailed them out as opposed to prioritize and let the provinces decide? Let's give it to the healthcare and essential workers, which makes sense to keep the healthcare system going. But big picture, wouldn't it make more sense to just almost like a public opinion poll? The more people you talk to, the more accurate it is.
I would agree 100%. And I'm not sure if you remember, but you and I had this conversation almost a year ago, kind of talking about, does it make sense for us to have rapid tests in our home so that we can use it so that we're able to go on with, living our lives? And I think that's, that could be our way out of this. Like just having that security that, you know, I'm doing, for example, I'm going to see a lab later this morning. And before I go there, I'm going to do a rapid test before I go in. So it just ensures that I'm not going to go in and potentially affect others. That would be a great thing if every single household could get a rapid test.
I almost feel like we've been shamed if we want to do what, as you described, the right thing, which is if you have this test, use it before you go visit grandma and grandpa, which was acceptable. And then suddenly it all changed.
Yeah. And I think that's because they're so limited right now. Right. And I think that's, and, you know, I've heard stories just in my community where they're handing out rapid tests in, you know, at different locations, and you've got, you know, 5-6 members of a family standing in line, and they just go and take 5-6 kids and take them to the house. And now they've got 30. Like, that's not right.
Wow.
Right. That's not the behavior we want to see in Ontario. We want to see what you're saying, which is like, if you've got symptoms, you want to take it, make sure you're not spreading it for others, and only do it if you absolutely have to.
I don't know if this is the million-dollar question and if you have an answer, but is the worst over? Are we worse? Are we like peaking now? And is it, or do you think that we're in this for, if not another variant, but at least until they get to the other side of this one?
You know, I was in visiting a lab on Monday, and I asked them that question because I think they're in a better situation to answer that because they're living and breathing it every day. And, you know, interesting, because the lab manager there said to me, like, they're actually quite hopeful. They said that, you know, they'll probably be able to take a deep breath in about 14 days because they've committed to, you know, assessment centers that have appointments up until the 8th of January. But she said, you know, I think things are going to look better. She said, I really feel like in the next 8 weeks that things are going to start to look up. So if that's any hope, I hang on to that and just kind of try to wake up every day and be as positive as possible and try to make this life that we have right now as normal as possible.
I think we just peaked in this interview. We're hanging on to that, Michelle. You know, when those on the front lines are saying stuff like that and they're seeing it, I mean, they're seeing the effects more than anybody. Fingers crossed that they're right. Appreciate it. Thank you, Michelle, as always.
No problem. Have a good day.
You too. Michelle Hode is CEO of the Medical Laboratory Professionals of Ontario. Coming up to 10:30, we'll break for an update from Chris Holsky. And on the other side, the wastewater. What is it showing? As we hold our breath and hope that it's good. That's next. News Talk 580 CFRA.
You're listening to Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Well, we know that Omicron has really overwhelmed COVID-19 testing system that was put in place. And one place that perhaps we should be looking more to, because it hasn't been overwhelmed just because of the way they do their work, is the wastewater monitoring program. Of course, we know here in Ottawa, we are among the best in the world. Dr. Rob Della Tola is back, co-lead investigator in Ottawa's coronavirus wastewater monitoring program. Dr. Rob, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy New Year.
And back to you. Is it a Happy New Year? What are the latest numbers you're seeing?
Yeah, not so great. So the latest data from yesterday in the wastewater is, if anybody's looked online, you'll see that it's been going up. And the latest data point we submitted to Ottawa Public Health this morning is it went up even further. In fact, we're reaching that same sort of highest point that we saw in April. So yeah, we're really right back up there in terms of the wastewater at this point.
Now, that was Delta back in April, correct?
That was, yeah.
And now we've got Omicron. So do you want to take a stab on what the difference means? Even though the numbers are up, is it as bad or worse?
Well, if you're looking at if you're doing a comparative, I know new clinical case numbers, we've exceeded testing capacity and we've changed the testing strategy and requirement to get tested here in Ontario. So it's, you know, that relationship is maybe more difficult to kind of really understand. But if you think about those massive new clinical case numbers we were seeing, and you compare that to the wastewater, then the relationship is different. I mean, even though we were spiking in terms of case numbers in April back with Delta, you know, the numbers never really reached the values we got to and what we saw recently. So the fact that the wastewater is lower means that, you know, people are less of it's ending up in the wastewater. So it's less of it's being shed somehow, whether that's, you know, fecal shedding or if it's from sputum or from some source. So yeah, the relationship has changed. Is that indicative of what's happening in terms of, you know, in terms of severity of disease? I'm not really sure. I think that's a question for others to answer. Mm. But there definitely is a shift there.
So let's dig a little deeper. So are we surpassing previous levels? I mean, as we are with the daily counts in testing?
Well, yeah, with the you know, I think what we're seeing with the wastewater, that the wastewater is independent of clinical tests, like how many tests we run out and how many tests we roll out and are able to run in the city. And, you know, with the overburdening of the testing system and really reaching that capacity and exceeding it, what we see is that the wastewater hasn't changed since prior to that and post that. So, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages, Leslie, of every metric. The wastewater has the advantage of not being linked to the number of clinical tests you are able to run within a city. So in that respect, what we're seeing with the wastewater, I think, is really quite important right now, because I think it's really giving us a continued understanding of the viral load within the community, even though the testing strategy has changed.
Right. And does that worry you?
Yeah, it's not great news. What worries me, really, to be honest with you, Leslie, is that we know that the wastewater is linked to hospitalization. We've seen that like for the past year and a half. So, you know, it hasn't risen as much relative to clinical testing before they changed the testing strategy. We knew that. That's still, I think, a good sign. The issue that it's rising now worries me for sure in terms of what we might see down the road. Hopefully, I'm totally wrong with that. Hopefully, that Omicron will not result in that much of an increase in hospitalizations. But this increase in the wastewater has showed us that before. There still seems to be potentially a relationship with wastewater and hospitalizations that seems to be maintaining a strong relation. So hopefully that just doesn't come to fruition, but it might be a little bit of a red flag for what's to come.
Could the third booster shot make the difference, though, and not actually lead to the number of hospitalizations despite the virus shedding itself?
Yeah, I think that is, that's what we're hoping. I think that's a question for public health. And, Dr. Vera Etches has been great in sort of guiding us towards that. And so has, you know, PHO. I think that's our light at the end of the tunnel. That's our kind of, parachute here is to kind of get boosted, keep getting vaccinated, and hopefully that will maybe prevent for what's to come in terms of at least severity of disease.
Going forward, what will this testing? I mean, obviously, people are shifting over to you because of the way in which the testing system has now shifted. So how can that be useful?
Yeah, and I think right now, in this point in time, I think is when it's probably most useful for the communities that are doing it. And in Ontario, we're really, really lucky that we have 175 sites across the province doing it. And, it's really hard to predict off of a clinical metric that maybe is not being able to kind of fully give us the full perspective. So, we've been having discussions with different groups, and especially Doug Manuel, who's been such a great resource for us again here in Ottawa, in terms of now looking to modeling the wastewater for predictive uses in terms of what's to come within the community. And we're really hoping to stand that up, and I'd really love to see that come to fruition, because I think it'll give us at least an indication. While we lost the ability perhaps to do that with clinical data, I think that the wastewater is in a really good position to help us do that and to predict what's to come in the province.
So can you, in a couple of sentences, sum up what it's predicting right now?
We haven't applied the predictive models to it. And I think that the question is, can we? And my answer to that, Leslie, and maybe my voice isn't the strongest one in this, but my answer is that we should. I think that the wastewater has been an indicator and a strong metric that's shown that it's able to triangulate and able to mimic clinical metrics. So without clinical cases right now maybe representing the full total number of clinical cases in the society, I'm hoping that the scientific community will start modeling the wastewater so that we can have predictive numbers in Ontario again.
How many spots do you take samples from in our city?
In our city, we do five at the University of Ottawa. We do four neighborhoods, and we do one at the central plant. So if you add that all up, if I'm not mistaken, 10.
And that would show pockets of where it's spreading faster than other parts of the city, right?
Yeah, we're looking at different neighborhoods, and we could see different signals in different neighborhoods for sure.
How much of that is based on density versus unvaccination rates?
Yeah, so for density, we do this kind of odd thing where we normalize for this frequently shed biomarker Pepper mild model virus. So density, the numbers that we get and we put up are really modified to account for density of people. Mm. So so when we look at those numbers, it's you know, some of the communities we look at here are as small as 5,000 people, other are as large as, you know, like 20,000 people. So, but it accounts for it. So the units that we do that copies for copies PMMOV account for density. So we can definitely see a relative signal from one neighborhood to another, and we could see that on campus as well.
As you you're now using the marker for Omicron, right? You can now tell how much of the COVID in our community is Omicron versus Delta. Do you have a breakdown?
Yeah, we've been tracing Omicron. As soon as we heard that Omicron has been identified, we heard the news coming out of South Africa. We designed a specific PCR test to test for Omicron, very similar to the way they do it, you know, they do it mainly through sequencing right now clinically. But we designed a specific test that will just find Omicron as opposed to finding all of the COVID signal within the wastewater. And we tracked it, and we saw that it rose quickly within the middle of the month. Within the middle of the month of December, we started to get real reliable hits for Omicron. And within a week or so, it was all the way at 90%. And we're still measuring above 90% Omicron in our wastewater samples since that point.
Wow. So it quickly, as we were warned, it spreads quickly and now dominates.
Absolutely. And it spread really quickly, Leslie. Like it was just a matter of a week to 2 weeks before it went from non-detect in the wastewater to greater than 90%.
How soon after getting COVID does it no longer show up in your stools?
Yeah, those are questions we're still trying to answer. The science isn't really... hasn't answered that one completely yet. That there's been relatively few studies still on really fecal shedding rate. There's been some good ones that have come out. We know basically at this point that it could shed for a significant number of days and time. But what we are learning is that when it sheds, it sort of spikes. So it's not necessarily doesn't shed the same amount over those days that someone who is sick would be fecally shedding. So it sort of has this sort of rapid increase and decrease. But again, there's not a whole lot of studies out there. We're waiting for more information to come out about that.
Could it be when this is all said and done and you worry, just because when you see the virus, you know, spiking and growing in the wastewater, that it could actually be part of the solution, that it's going through and people aren't getting sick, but they're asymptomatic, in other words, but they're getting it, quote unquote, over with?
Yeah, I think what we've seen when we had the onset of the vaccination and when vaccination exceeded or reached 80% within the community, we started to see a shift in the wastewater signal relative to clinical cases. And what we started to see is that even though people were testing positive, we started to see that they weren't really as many people were fecally shedding. Mm. And we think that you shed more when you have a higher burden of disease, when there's more severity of sickness within the individual. So, so what we started to see is that, you know, there was unvaccinated people that were likely asymptomatic and unvaccinated people that might have been, you know, having the virus, but they might not have known it. And what we saw is that they got tested for whatever reason. They may have been contacted. They decided to get tested, and we weren't really seeing that high of signal in the wastewater. So we think that from what we see in the wastewater, the more severe the illness in the individual, the more they will fecally shed.
When this is all said and done, you see this as a tool that will continue to be used for future viruses, whatever?
Yeah, we really hope so. You know, we built up this wonderful infrastructure in Ottawa. We built it up all across Ontario. And for that matter, throughout Canada, there's 250 sites doing this in Canada, Leslie. There's 175 of them, yes, are in Ontario.
Wow.
But across the country, there's 250. I would love to see this not be eroded. I would love to see this continue in our lab. You know, we're chasing Omicron. We didn't know Omicron was going to come. We shifted gears to make sure we could find that and monitor it. But before that happened, we were putting a lot of our efforts into looking at influenza, respiratory viruses, other sort of disease targets that we could translate this knowledge to down the road.
I was reading this goes all the way back. We were able to do it, trace it, polio in the water.
Yeah, polio in the water for 25 years. And not only polio in the water and other people's water, there was a group, actually, I learned this a couple of months ago. There was a group in at the University of Ottawa, Dr. Syed Sattar's group and Susan Springthorpe, who did this, who were tracing polio in Ottawa's wastewater in the 1970s.
Wow. Wow.
And so continuing that heritage.
Yeah, and if you had done this at the beginning or had the ability, because it would still be around, would it have made a difference in how it's playing out?
I think so. I think that, you know, if we would have built on that sort of success then and really built it up, then I think what you would see is we wouldn't have had to wait for it to build up across the province. And right now we wouldn't probably be having questions on, well, can we model wastewater in place of clinical cases? Can we actually do that? I think those questions would have been answered. And in my opinion, I think we would be using wastewater now to model severity and hospitalizations down the road.
Well, let's hope some of the lessons we ignored last time that we're going to learn from and implement measures to protect us from, God forbid, next time. Dr. Rob De La Tola, always appreciate your conversation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, be well.
You too. Rob De La Tola, co-lead investigator in Ottawa's Coronavirus Wastewater Monitoring Program. It is 10:48. We'll take a break. News Talk 580 CFRA. All right, I want to focus on, well, canceled or postponed surgeries right now. Because we talk a lot about how the system is overwhelmed because of COVID, but they are consequences. They're being bumped out, these people who are waiting for surgeries, some of whom have cancer. And they're saying, you're going to have to wait. And their answer is, well, cancer is not going to wait. Let's bring in Marie-Louise Doyle, Executive Director of Breast Cancer Action Ontario. Good morning, Marie-Louise. Thank you.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I am well. Most importantly, give me a snapshot of what people that are members of your association are facing right now.
Well, what they're facing is their spirits are being broken. Those who are being diagnosed with breast cancer, their families, their friends who are trying to support them. This is the second time this is happening. At the onset of the pandemic, mastectomies were canceled for anywhere from 3 to 8 month waiting period.
Wow.
And then, of course, they had to work through the backlog, which meant the newly diagnosed were being held at bay until they got through their backlog. So it's a pretty rough time. And since the newspaper article the other day, and of course, thank you very much for having me on. We've been receiving calls from people from all over the place who are not just dealing with breast cancer. I received a call from a woman whose daughter does have breast cancer, and she was begging me to help her.
And you can't
because
do, yeah.
her daughter's breast cancer surgery has been delayed, and she's just at her wit's end. So it's a very hard spot to be in.
Obviously, the mental strain waiting for that surgery, now delayed once again, is frustrating. But do we know? And I guess I know the answer to this question, but I want to hear it. What are the consequences of waiting 3 or 8 months for surgery? What is that? How does that affect potentially the prognosis?
People are going to die.
Yeah.
It's that simple. I mean, a lot of what's happening right now is, well, we could see this and we could see that. So, yes, people could die. The health research has made it clear that you can't even hold off surgery for a month.
Cancer's not going to wait was the quote
it's
that jumped
out. It's not going to wait
me.
For
yeah.
you.
So the way in which the decision makers are handling cancer versus elective surgeries, cancer surgeries, does that need to change? Is that the answer here?
Well, for me, it does need to change because, you know, I mean, it's hard. You know, I had a family member whose hip surgery was postponed for 4 months, but, you know, they did end up getting their hip surgery. But you can't compare having a disease in your body that can kill you to dealing with, you know, a worn out hip, you know, or other things. So although I've been asking the question since this pandemic started, no one has been able to answer me as to why any sort of cancer or any sort of, you know, life-threatening disease, why these surgeries are being postponed. There should not even be a discussion about whether they're elective, whether they're required, whether they're essential.
Should we follow the ER model? He who needs the fastest treatment to save their lives gets front of the line, i.e. COVID, and then those who are next up with potential prognosis changes if they don't get it ASAP be number two, and then those who are waiting for a hip in this particular case would be number three in priority?
Well, for me, this is the dichotomy. This is what's happening. I mean, you know, the leadership is trying to save the country from, you know, getting this virus, which is understandable. But you can't put one set of Canadian citizens on the back burner while you're dealing with another one. You have to deal with this concurrently.
And what does that mean? Does that mean working all night? I mean, where do you get the surgeons?
Well, they're already working all night.
Yeah.
I mean, the pandemic has brought to light the healthcare system that is, you know, in pretty rough shape. I mean, it's always been in rough shape. A friend of mine who's a retired nurse said, you know, nobody cared in the 60s when I was working 14 hours a day.
Yeah.
And there were 25 people waiting in Emerge. You know, she was saying, like, it's always been this way. And I mean, anyone who's gone to sit in emergency, you know, as a walk-in knows you could be there for a day before you're seen. So, I mean, the thing is, it's not the medical practitioners and all of the staff that surround that sector that are at fault here. They are all doing the best they can. Their hands are being tied by decision makers because they're being told.
Is the solution throw more money at it, make it more efficient, completely overhaul it, start from scratch? Where would you go if you were in?
I think that's, and to me, that's a completely separate issue. So
yeah.
COVID has really brought the healthcare system to light. And these lockdowns and everything that's going on, really, we're a country, like many others, whose mental health is in crisis. And do I feel that it's, you know, with the healthcare system, do we just start over? There's a lot of good parts to this healthcare system. But, and I don't know if throwing, I think if you invest, you're not throwing money at it. If you invest in the Canadian people and you make investments in the provincial healthcare programs,
yeah,
and the federal government, you know, who has the budget that farms down to the provinces and the territories, there needs to be an assessment. I mean, there have been tons of assessments. There have been a ton of brainstorming sessions on how to fix this system. But we need to move toward fixing the system. I don't really think it's a surprise anymore, you know, that we are having a rough time and that this pandemic has really brought a lot of the healthcare system, you know, is giving it a negative light. But I mean, we work with the Breast Health Center, excuse me, and the practitioners there are fantastic. And they're doing the best they can with, you know, with the boxes they've been put in.
So I want to go back to what your retired nurse friend had to say about, you know, they didn't help me when I was working 14-hour days back in the 60s. So I'm curious, does the survival rate of cancer, well, I'll talk specifically to your wheelhouse, breast cancer, is it better in countries where the healthcare is better? Is that a safe assumption?
I don't know if that's really a safe assumption because there are many types of breast cancer. It really depends.
Okay.
You have to break it down and you have to look at, you know, is it metastatic? Is it invasive lobular? Where is it?
And maybe if it was an easy answer, we wouldn't be in this mess because we could.
You know what I mean? And I don't feel that I'm the expert to really answer that question fairly.
Fair enough. So what do you tell the people who are calling you and saying, help me or help my daughter?
I tell them that we're here for them. And we have a bunch of programs. We have a post-surgical grandma's all through the Kelly Project. The biggest thing that's happening that's really come to light for us is our peer support program. So our peer supporters are incredible people. They're volunteers. They're trained volunteers who provide peer support, and they're all survivors.
Right.
So when we partner, you know, a longtime survivor with a newly diagnosed, what they get is an incredible ear and an incredible shoulder to listen to. So, I mean, the biggest thing for us is that since the pandemic started, we've seen an increase in 82% of referrals to the peer support program. There are days I can get 10 or 12 calls and one for one ask for peer support.
Wow.
So, because you're already scared. So, I mean, you're, you know, you found something, your doctor's found something, you do the test, you do what needs to be done. the diagnosis comes down that you do have breast cancer, the next step is to meet your surgeon, get your surgery date. But the thing about this breast cancer ordeal, or a cancer ordeal of any kind, is that the surgery is step one.
Right.
It's after the surgery what comes. Are you going to have chemo? Are you going to have radiation? Are you going to be on tamoxifen? What is going to be the adjuvant therapy to follow? How long is that therapy going to last? The longer you hold up the surgery, the longer you hold up the fight and the recovery.
And chances are we'll prolong that because more invasive it becomes. And then so forth, potentially the treatment becomes more invasive.
Yeah, I had a lady call the other day. She's in her early 30s. She has a child at home. She's not only dealing with breast cancer, she's also dealing with having to homeschool. Huh. So, I mean, you know, how all I can do is let them cry. And get them to the program that can support them the best. I mean, when you're diagnosed with a disease of any form, it's very personal.
And you rely on doctors and the system to look after you because that's where we're raised. We're universal healthcare. And that is letting us down right now.
And and to me, it's almost as if the compassion is gone. I mean, where is your compassion? How can you sit there and make a decision that will impact sick people all over the country, but not only that, their children, their spouses, their partners, their colleagues, their friends.
Do you feel the mental
health crisis being paid is just it's unacceptable.
And you don't feel like it's being taken into account when decisions are being made, clearly.
I don't feel that. No, I mean, I know we're all being Canadian, we're all trying to be supportive of the decision makers. And, oh, we've never seen this before. It's been 20 months. It's been 20 months.
I can only imagine when the women call you, if they didn't have a service like Breast Cancer Action Ottawa, what they'd be feeling right now. What toll is it taking on your volunteers?
Our volunteers are feeling the strain, where a few of them have opted to take a break.
Yeah.
It's rough. You know, and I mean, it's, you know, because like whenever the phone rings, I am thrilled that I am here to answer the call. And I know that organizations like ours don't exist all over the country because I have people calling me from all over the country, especially, you know, since these interviews and everything. People are reaching out just begging for help because they're terrified.
Do you need more help in terms of resources, volunteers, people who've been through it? Is there if someone's listening out and says, hey, I wish I could help, is there any way they can?
Well, yeah, I mean, we always need volunteers. I mean, the pandemic really did decimate us financially because the majority of our funding came from third-party fundraisers, and, of course, those are all canceled.
Right.
And many, you know, some pivoted, but not all have the capacity to pivot. So, if you Google Breast Cancer Action, will pop up. You can give me a call or shoot me an email. And if there's any way you'd like to help, sure.
We hear the call to action right there. Mary Louise Doyle, thank you. Appreciate it. And thanks for all you're doing.
Great. Well, thanks very much for the opportunity.
Cheers. Executive Director of Breast Cancer Action Ottawa. You're speechless. I don't know what to say after you hear that. There are no words that can make this better. At least not the right people. Possibly the action that would be required are not sitting behind this microphone, unfortunately. 11:18, we'll take a break. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA. Share your opinion now. Text us at 580-580. Please include your name and where you're texting from. Standard text rates may apply.
You know that song, of course, Ed Sheeran's Bad Habits. Ed Sheeran is making quite the name for himself in the music business of today. But in 25 years from now, do you think we'll be listening to Ed Sheeran and saying, remember that great album? We're going to look back to 25 years ago. And we're going to look at some of the albums and see what considered at the time influential and how they potentially influenced music and whether they actually stood the test of time. Who else but music expert Eric Alper to join us on this Music Friday. Good morning, Eric.
Hey, Leslie, how are you?
I am well, thank you. Here's my question for you. When you look at the 90s, because when I look 25 years, Matt Gita and producer and I went, that's the late 90s. I said, 25 years. Boy, they flew by. I would have thought, you know, decades before that, but no. Sort of dating myself here. But if you look at the 90s and influence on music, where does it rank compared to other decades?
I'd say it's probably lower than the 60s, probably lower than the 80s. But the 90s were certainly up there. You know, there was a time of really big change for the music industry. You had festivals like the Lilith Fair that busted down the doors for women playing in music festivals and women getting heard on the radio. Certainly, you know, with the help of grunge music and rock, and you had Britney Spears and Nirvana sometimes on the same stations. It was probably the last gasp of absolute bonkers amount of money that the music industry was making up until the last couple of years, thanks to streaming. This is when CDs were selling a million copies a week for some artists, just numbers that they've never really been able to achieve since then.
So you put a list together for us, and I can tell the folks there's a different genre. They're not all one. There's a Canadian. There is a legend who you don't necessarily associate with the 90s. And then some people who are still around making music today. So we're going to begin our countdown as we look back at, you know, albums turning 25 this year. We're going to start with Oasis, and the song is Do You Know What I Mean? Why did Oasis make your list, and that's that album in particular?
Yeah, when they released their What's the Story Morning Glory album back in 1995, that's the one with Wonderwall on it. It sold 16 million copies around the world and really brought guitar music back in a big way, at least to the UK. And that's usually where, you know, the cool music is coming from. It's cool Britain, it's Liverpool, it's the Beatles, it's everybody. When they released that album, Be Here Now, it was kind of, kind of pinpointed the downfall of Britpop. It went from selling 16 million copies of their last album. This one sold just over 3 million copies. Not too shabby, but it really signaled the end of rock music in Britain and was soon overtaken by pop and R&B and rap. So this album is still a great guitar record if you're missing rock music, but it's also one that you can look in the background and say, that's when it all started to go sour.
Well, is it because the album was not great, or was the last of the great ones?
I think people were just tired of hearing kind of the same music for a number of years. You know, audiences are fickle, as you probably know, hosting your own show, and very few genres last at the top of the most listened to style of music for only a couple of years until it's overtaken. People grow up, they get older. What they're listening to at 19 years old isn't what they want to listen to when they're 24 or 25. So, you know, and people kind of look for something a little bit different.
Okay, up next, definitely an alternative but popular Radiohead and the song Karma Police. Are you a Radiohead fan, Eric?
Yeah, they can do no wrong by me. And I know a lot of people are like, I think I know, you know, maybe Creep
right.
by them. But
yeah.
When OK Computer came out, it just stunned the music world. I mean, I don't think anybody was looking at them with the direction of this is where we're going to go for music in all sorts of form. It was rock, it was artsy, it was progressive, it was experimental, and it's actually in the Library of Congress as one of the greatest albums of all time. So if you're looking for something a little bit challenging and maybe haven't put it on in a while, this is the album for you this weekend.
Are they going to tour? Are they done?
I think that they're done touring. I think most artists are kind of done touring, at least for this year. But yeah, I probably expect them to go out and tour, and they have a really an all-new album, probably in 2023, 24. But your guess is as good as mine when we're ever going to see them back on the road again.
Okay, this next song by a group that I don't really remember, but and I didn't know the name of it, but I recognized it instantly. It is The Verve and Bittersweet Symphony.
Symphony that's
I should know that name because it was right there, of course, in the chorus. But I think it was always in the background in movies I watched. I don't know if that's maybe how I know it.
Yeah, he was in quite a lot of movies. The reason why this song and this album, not only was this album massive in the UK and in America, thanks to the song Bittersweet Symphony, but it changed the way that the music industry felt about sampling and other groups using other people's music in their song. Those strings that you hear, which kind of makes up the best part of the song, is actually a sample of Rolling Stones song called The Last Time. Well, the group never got permission from Mick Jagger and Keith Richards to use it, and in turn 100% of the royalties of that song went to those two guys, which is essentially every penny that the band made on selling about 7 million copies of this album worldwide went back to the Rolling Stones. In fact, it was only a couple of years ago where Mick and Keith gave back the ability for the band to make royalties, something like 24, 23 years after the album first came out.
Was that the first, what do you call it when you take, sampling? Was that kind of like the first sampling, or did they steal it?
Yeah, that was the first time I think that the music industry really, and the lawyers especially, really started to clamp down. It was okay when artists from the rap world were doing maybe 10,000 copies or 8,000 copies of a song in America. They didn't really care because that was the way that rap started. It was essentially using other people's beats or other people's lyrics as a starting point or as a blast off to their own music. When you start to sell 1 million copies, that's when the lawyers start to go, some of that money should be ours. And in fact, all of the money should have been, you know, Mick and Keith. But, you know, that's what happened.
All right. Next up, a band that some are calling the today's greatest rock band. They've been around a long time, and they have, they've even done a cover of Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley. You know who I'm talking about. The Foo Fighters. And the song is Everlong. Eric, should we just call that band Dave Grohl and his friends? Because doesn't Dave do all the work? Isn't he the business guy? Isn't he the music guy? Isn't he the everything?
It's funny. If you ask Dave Grohl that, he would say it's actually, you know, the band plus Dave Grohl. I mean, he gives a lot of credit to the band for keeping him sane, for keeping him surviving out there, and for actually, you know, helping him create those songs that he has in his brain. You know, The Color and the Shape is the band's biggest album. It sold over 6 million copies in America and here in Canada. And it's amazing because those songs like Monkey Wrench and My Hero and Everlong are probably the most depressing lyrically, because some have to do with Kurt Cobain. Some have to do with his divorce of his then wife. But they're probably the most stadium filler album and songs that he's ever released.
Yeah, it certainly was an album that will stand the test of time, as the band seems to do, too, because they're going to be touring again. Well, I guess they are, right? Just not in Canada.
Yeah, they were supposed to be coming to Toronto and Hamilton and I think Montreal and Ottawa, too, for 2021. So they canceled those dates. They're back on the schedule for 2022, and cross fingers and hope that that they can actually go through with it.
I actually saw them. One of them, Pat Smear, is a friend of Bill Carroll's. When Bill was in L.A., he befriended Pat, and they're very good friends. And so, because I know Bill, went backstage, and when Dave broke his leg, and it was the Quebec, they were playing Quebec. It was the big festival there. It was pouring rain.
The festival that...
Yeah. They did, the Summer Festival, and they canceled it after the fourth song because it was lightning. And all I remember is seeing a whole bunch of guys carrying Dave Grohl, like it was almost like he was on a stretcher, away from the stage into the back. It was very surreal, but very cool.
He probably thought it was the coolest thing. He was probably like, this is the greatest light show I could ever ask for.
Right, except the safety director said, no, we're stopping it now, unfortunately. And then we all happened to have garbage bags and wore ponchos made out of green garbage bags to get out of that concert. But that's a whole other story. All right, next up, I've never heard of this group. It's Blur. I hope they know the song. It's Song 2. Why did Blur make your list?
Yeah, so Blur and Oasis were kind of like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones of their day. They were arguing in the media a lot. They were making fun of one another. Whenever one band released a single, the other one would release at the same time. And Blur was actually pretty big here in North America. But that song, Song 2, ended up being bigger than both bands ever cataloged. It was massive in terms of sporting arenas, and it's a song that kind of makes fun of rock and roll and the whole grunge thing, thinking that we can have a chorus with just woohoo in it and it'll actually make the charts. And look what happened. It actually made the charts and became one of the biggest sellers of the rock era.
All right, still come. We'll take a quick break here. A folk legend who you don't think of in the 90s when it comes to music, a rap superstar, a Canadian icon, and Will Smith. All that and more on the other side. Eric Alper as we do Music Friday right here on News Talk 580 CFRA.
580 CFRA. Be a part of the conversation. Text us at 580 580. Please include your name and where you're texting from. Standard text rates may apply.
Music Friday this time, Eric Alper, our favorite music guy, has put together, well, a list of influential albums turning 25 this year. And we're asking the question, do they hold up and what is the significance they've made to music? Well, this next guy, no question the significance he's made to music, but I wouldn't have thought of him from the 90s. We're talking Bob Dylan and the song Make You Feel My Love. My Bob Dylan joke is, imagine if they had auto-tune back in the day for him. And then the Dylan fans hate me.
You can actually play Adele's version of that song on 16 RPM and slow it down, and it'll probably sound something very similar to Bob Dylan's voice.
Paul is dead is what comes out, right?
Exactly. It's amazing how awful Bob Dylan's 1980s and kind of 1990s were. You know, he had not a lot of really good selling albums. He certainly wasn't on the radio a lot. Nobody really predicted that he was going to make a comeback. In fact, in 1990, he released an album called Under the Red Sky, which was a huge disappointment, both in terms of critics and in terms of sales. He released a couple of albums after that, but nothing of new material until Time Out of My Mind. He went back to work with Daniel Lanois, the Canadian producer, ended up getting Grammy of the Year for album back in 1998. But this was an album that kind of solidified the legendary status. People were calling him out and saying he might not be the person you think he is anymore, but then he goes ahead and releases this classic album that is still one of the best in his catalog.
Let's do a shout out to Daniel Lanois, because he's worked with some of the best. U2, of course, even Canada's own Luba. This guy apparently is one of the nicest guys in the music business.
The sweetest guy in the world. I've met him on many, many occasions. He used to play with the Downchild Blues Band back in the late 60s, early 70s.
What was that song called? Flip, Rock, and Fly? What was that song?
Yeah, Flip, Flop, and Fly.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And then he went on to work with Neil Young and Peter Gabriel and Aaron Neville and the Neville Brothers. I mean, what a genius he is.
I hope he's rich, because a lot of people got rich because of his talent. Does a producer get a good chunk of the cash?
Yeah, I think probably once he started renegotiating his deals after that U2 album for the Joshua Tree started selling 35 million copies, I'm sure that he gets a little bit of points for it. But I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't. You know, some producers, they don't like to get percentages or profits off of albums because they feel like it harms the way that they work with the artist. Because then they want to be more commercial rather than, you know, feed the artistic statement that the artist wants to make.
Okay, next up, Missy Elliott and the song The Rain, Super Duper Fly. I don't know if it's a coincidence, but as PJ played that song, the sun came out here in the Byward Market. Hilarious.
Because God is a woman, and you know, Mother Nature loves Missy Elliott. I mean, who doesn't?
Why did she make your list?
Well, you know, going back to the beginning of this conversation that you and I had talking about why the 90s were so great, and Lilith Fair happens to be one of those really great things that happened in the 1990s. Miss Elliott became the first female rapper to actually appear on the festival back in 1998, thanks to the success of this record. But this record combined electronic music, R&B, hip hop, soul. Like Lauryn Hill, she definitely led the women revolution when it came to rap and hip hop. And really, even today, these new artists that are coming up, like Billie Eilish and Olivia Rodrigo, think Missy Elliott is a stone cold genius. And she is, pretty much because of albums like this.
You talked about the decade for females in music, specifically rock, and yet Jagged Little Pill, Alanis Morissette, isn't on your list. Is there any reason why?
Because we can't do an hour.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. It isn't necessarily in this order, but
no slight to her.
It would be.
I have talked about her a lot.
We have, yeah, we have. All right, next up, from one Canadian, Alanis, to another, Shania Twain, and well, you know it. Here it is, the anthem.
The best thing about being a woman is the prerogative to have a little fun. Oh, 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 we're totally crazy.
Now, I really think she ripped off in that music video. What was she dressed up like, what's his name, Robert Palmer, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
On purpose, tell me? Did she do that on purpose?
On purpose.
Okay.
Totally on purpose.
Perfect.
Yeah,
okay.
Just being the whole narrative of the way that country music was perceived, and using today's imagery, using today's philosophies. I mean, there's a song on the record that, you know, wasn't even, you know, a huge single, but it was called If You Want to Touch Her, Ask. That was very different than the hee-haw country music that a lot of us had grown up on. But 16 songs on the record, 12 of them were singles. They were releasing songs to radio almost 3 years after this album came out. 40 million copies sold, the biggest selling album of all time for a female solo artist, the biggest country album of all time. There's nobody that's going to be able to touch this record. I mean, if this album came out in the era of social media, I think we would never have heard from Shania Twain again. I don't think that she would have been able to handle that wave of success that comes with social media.
And Mutt Lange, that was the name of her ex-husband, right, who did all
that?
Yeah. I mean, that was the album that also put him on the map?
Yeah, absolutely. He was the one that brought those AC/DC, Van Halen, rock elements to country music that's still heard today. You know, country music is really about rap and hip-hop, and it's all really about rock and roll, you know, mixture into that country music. And Shania really had a lot to do with the latter part of it.
Well, and Shania, clearly, as we saw, if you even look at the most recent Country Music Awards in the United States, she paved the way for what they call hot country now. So pop country is what I call it, right? And you see all the younger female artists sort of bowing to her and acknowledging her because of what she did to allow them to have a career.
Yeah, you know, on one side you have Dolly Parton, which everybody loves.
Loves.
And then you have Shania Twain on the other side, simply because she was the one that sold the most in order to have women on country music radio. You know, back then, maybe you heard one woman, maybe an hour. Now you hear, you know, four or five, and mostly because Shania Twain was able to prove to radio programmers that women were worthy of being heard on the radio. It sounds bizarre, but that's just how it was.
Fair to say, without Shania, there'd be no Carrie Underwood?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I think Shania Twain helped make country music viable for record labels to sign, and that kind of opened up the doors for somebody like American Idol and those shows to have country music not just middle America, but to New York and Los Angeles and Toronto and Ottawa and Montreal.
All right, next up, one of my favorite actors. He's got a great book out right now, but he was first known, of course, for music. We're talking Will Smith, Getting Jiggy With It.
Big Willie Styles already getting jiggy with it. Getting jiggy with it.
Going to Miami. Oh, wrong song. Wrong song. But there's this, you know, it's like he's got a formula and he knows how to make it work. And that era.
Yeah, you know, back in the DJ Fresh Prince, and he was, you know, the Fresh Prince, and he was an actor on the comedy shows and on the sitcom. And then when he released that album, in the 1990s, Big Willie style, back in 1997, he really elevated his status to absolute no-brainer superstar. You know, that allowed him to be that triple threat where he could sing current stuff and act and probably dance in that video. You know, he's made just over $9 billion at the box office. Billion. I mean, just it all really started for him to be taken seriously in entertainment, I think, with that album.
Not surprising he had success at a young age, first as a rapper, of course, then the television show. But he's become more humble. Have you seen the Fresh Prince reunion?
I didn't.
Okay, so you know they changed his aunt, right? His aunt Viv. Yeah. Because apparently his ego was getting so big on the set in the early days that she was telling him, hey, keep grounded. He got her fired. And so she confronts him in the reunion and says, you ruined my career. You ruined my family. And he literally took it and owned it in terms of ownership. So I had a lot of respect for him because you know that he didn't have to put that in there.
Yeah, and also, you know, having somebody that's so social media savvy, like his wife, Jada Pinkett.
Red table, yep.
Yeah, is just, you know, that's a hard thing to be in that hurricane all the time. You know, it's not easy. Look, it's not easy to be a successful, you know, celebrity in today's world anyway, but to have that in your entire family, I mean, more props to whatever Jada and Will want to do with their lives.
Music expert Eric Alper, always appreciate your choices and your incredible knowledge. Thank you for sharing this part of Friday with us.
Have a great weekend.
You too, Eric Alper.